The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. Leonard Bernstein's Mass, his meditation on life, on love, his crisis of faith, his cry for peace, Yannick Nezet-Séguin, the Philadelphia Orchestra, and performers from around the community come together for Leonard Bernstein's Mass. Tickets at 215-893-1999 or at philorc.org. This Thursday through Sunday at the Kimmel Center, Leonard Bernstein's Mass with the Philadelphia Orchestra.
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Ahead this evening, we'll tour a research lab with a very concrete goal, preventing roads and bridges from falling apart. First, a steady stream of disgruntled customers helped kick off Philadelphia's hearings on Comcast service today. City officials hope those concerns give them leverage as they negotiate a new franchise deal that will give Comcast access to city streets and utility poles. WHYY's Bill Hangley reports.
Whether this week's Comcast hearings provide anything besides political theater remains to be seen, but that didn't stop dozens of customers from coming out to let Comcast know they're not happy. Here's a taste of what Comcast and city officials heard Tuesday at the Free Library on Rittenhouse Square.
I'm over 80 years old, but I'm not a fool. They're very nice to you, but they lie to you.
I find that companies like Comcast and Verizon that constantly ask for tax subsidies, and they promise high speeds and the drops in prices or something like that, and they never deliver.
You know, they pay 3.5-4% tax, and we're taxed 10%. I mean, I don't understand who's in charge.
You taught your people very well how to be politely rude.
Also, you should make public what they are actually doing to improve customer service. For years, I've been hearing that customer service has been improved. But as everyone here knows, there's no evidence of that.
I agree with several who said we should be able to pick and choose our programming. When I go to the supermarket to buy apples and grapefruits, the store doesn't make me buy kumquats, potatoes, and frozen pasta.
Those were Philadelphia residents Merle Mir-Moss, Oren Panich, Rosemary Devers, Mike Miller, and Barbara Silverstein. Comcast officials were also on hand, and they say they'll be listening and doing their best to improve. These public hearings will continue all week, while the franchise negotiations will probably last until the fall. For WHYY News, I'm Bill Hangley.
And this disclosure, Comcast supports WHYY. When you're nursing a cold, a big salad probably won't be your choice of comfort food. As WHYY's Jessica McDonald reports, researchers at the Monell Chemical Senses Center identify a link between the immune system and taste buds.
If broccoli loses its appeal when you're sick, blame an immune protein called TNF. Molecular biologist Hoan Wong says TNF can be helpful in fighting off an infection, but it's also made by taste bud cells and increases sensitivity to bitter flavors. In Wong's experiment, normal mice began avoiding bitter water, even at very small doses.
But when the TNF is not there, then these type of mice will wait until much higher concentration to start to avoid bitter taste.
It's not clear why TNF has an effect on bitter taste receptors, but Wong says one possibility is to protect people when they're already in a more vulnerable state.
We know that bitter taste is a warning signal, right? Bitter taste is related to toxins or other compounds that may be trouble to us.
Of course, the heightened sensitivity also makes it harder to take certain medications and keep weight on, especially for those suffering from chronic conditions. Wong says she hopes her experiments raise awareness about what happens to taste buds during illness and that caregivers will think more about what kinds of foods or medications are tolerable for patients with extra sensitive palates. I'm Jessica McDonald, WHYY News.
For the past few weeks, U.S. Senator Bob Menendez of New Jersey has had a federal indictment hanging over him, but WHYY Washington correspondent Matt Laszlo reports that Menendez seems to be conducting business as usual, even if the corruption allegations are following him like a dark storm cloud.
The Pentagon is probably the only building in the country where seniority matters more than here at the Capitol. And Senator Menendez, who graduated from the House in 2006, is New Jersey's senior senator. That's why at a recent press conference, Menendez was the first of four senators to speak on their legislation that would ban offshore oil and gas drilling on the East Coast.
I want to thank my colleagues who are here with me today to basically tell big oil that America's coastline is not for sale, not now and not ever.
Federal prosecutors aren't worried about Menendez selling the state's coastline. They're accusing him of selling his Senate seat. The federal indictment alleges he exchanged favors from his perch at the Capitol for close to $1 million in political donations and personal gifts, including free stays at a lavish Parisian hotel and a resort in the Dominican Republic. Menendez has pleaded not guilty, though to save his party some embarrassment, he stepped down as the top Democrat on the Foreign Relations Committee. Maryland Senator Ben Cardin replaced Menendez and has taken over as the lead Democratic negotiator on things like nuclear talks with Iran. As Cardin rode the subway at the Capitol, he refused to discuss the allegations against Menendez.
Well, I wouldn't comment on that. As I said publicly, I'll say again, I hope these issues are resolved quickly. I did not want to become ranking member this way.
While senators don't want to discuss the case pending against Menendez, his colleagues, like Senator Tim Kaine of Virginia, say he's handling things well.
Senator Menendez has been very positive about trying to make that as without tension as possible. I give him huge kudos for doing that, to picking any tension out of it. And we are very close as a committee on the Democratic side, and we're just keeping on rolling.
At least one Republican is coming to the aid of Menendez. Senator Mark Kirk is from Illinois. Yeah, the same Illinois that President Obama hails from. He argues the president is exacting revenge on Menendez because he was using his perch on the Foreign Relations Committee to undermine the administration's nuclear talks with Iran.
I worry that in Chicago, we apply kind of politics just to destroy and bury our enemies. And this is kind of Chicago politics with Bob.
Kirk doesn't have evidence, but he says if you think Jersey politics are rough, just come to Chicago, where the president was groomed.
When Justice Department people come to the president and say, hey, we were thinking about nailing Menendez to the wall, I think the president probably says, yeah, go for it.
That's a far-fetched conspiracy, according to many observers, even allies of Menendez, like New Jersey Congressman and fellow Democrat Bill Pascrell.
I mean, don't forget, this thing started a long time before we started debating Iran.
In
the context now, so I don't think that had anything to do with it whatsoever.
While Pascrell brushes aside conspiracies involving his friend, he defends Menendez against charges of taking bribes.
You know, a lot of this is superficial. He had problems when he ran last time, and he, in the middle of the campaign, they brought charges out against him, which was unethical in my mind. And he came out of that all right, and there's no reason to believe that he won't come out of this okay, and let justice prevail. That's it.
Menendez is basically accused of taking gifts in exchange for using his office to help Florida eye doctor Salmon Melgen win a multi-million-dollar Medicare dispute, along with helping him secure visas for Melgen's visiting girlfriends. Noah Bookbinder is with the group Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, or CREW. He says it's hard to see this case from the senator's perspective.
Even for members of the Senate, they're not generally receiving these kinds of lavish gifts from their personal friends. And they're not, while they may be intervening here and there to help out constituents and perhaps sometimes friends, this level of intervention seems way out of the norm.
Back in the Capitol, everyone is watching and waiting. Michigan Democratic Senator Debbie Stabenow serves on the committee Menendez used to chair.
I think it's really important to let the legal system play out. You know, I've enjoyed working with Bob on a lot of issues, and it's very unfortunate.
Stabenow says it's hard to watch this legal saga unfold.
Well, it's always difficult when something is happening to a friend. Yeah.
Menendez is one of just 12 senators in history to be indicted. One of them, Harrison Williams, was also from New Jersey. After being found guilty of bribery and corruption in 1981 as a part of the Abscam scandal, Williams resigned from the Senate before the body could vote to kick him out. It was just about then that Menendez was starting his career, wearing a bulletproof vest and testifying in the corruption trial of his mentor, Union City Mayor William Musto. Menendez vows he will be vindicated and remembered for fighting corruption, not for taking bribes. For WHYY, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
Taking a look at this evening's headlines, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie is sending 100 state troopers and 50 other enlisted personnel to Baltimore. They'll help the city control the rioting and unrest following the funeral of Freddie Gray, a black man who died of injuries sustained while in police custody. Attorney General John Hoffman says some of the troopers the state is sending have been dedicated to community policing.
They'll be both preserving the peace and doing so in a way that, that tries to help rebuild community relations and tries to help share some of the experiences that we have had in New Jersey in establishing such strong relationships.
The New Jersey troopers will join 2,000 troops from the Maryland National Guard who were sent in earlier today. Camden is one of the 8 places named a promise zone by the federal government today. It's a designation that could open the doors to get extra federal grants. Local officials and nonprofits collaborated on a 5-year plan to boost the economy, reduce crime, improve schools, improve citizens' health, and increase the supply of safe, affordable housing. 67 degrees, partly sunny skies on Independence Mall. It's 6:16. You're listening to Newsworks Tonight on WHYY. Mostly clear skies overnight, low 48 degrees. Tomorrow, sunny. Wednesday's high 72. Then clouding up Thursday with a 50% chance of showers. Thursday's high in the low 60s. Still ahead, we'll consider why Americans have been so reluctant to elect a woman for president.
One of the things that the surveys keep telling us is that American voters, male and female, are loath to give a woman military power, military control.
Newsworks Tonight continues on WHYY.
Thomas Jefferson School of Population Health supports WHYY. At Jefferson, health is all they do, and public health is a big part of it. Jefferson School of Population Health offers a fully accredited Master of Public Health degree. Classes begin in September, and merit scholarships are available. An information session will be held on Tuesday, May 12th at 5:30 p.m. For details or to register, online at jefferson.edu/publichealthinfo. Thomas Jefferson School of Population Health.
On the next Articulate, bass baritone Eric Owens is truly a homecoming king in Opera Philadelphia's production of Don Carlo. The work of Philadelphia's independent game designers may be game-changing in the debate over whether video games can now finally be considered a legitimate art form. And the soulful singer-songwriter Ginger Coyle tells of how she survived a decade of being put through the ringer by the music business. Join us for the next Articulate with me, Jim Cotter, Thursday at 10:30 on WHYY-TV.
Welcome back to Newsworks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. Recently announced Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton's campaign team is busy managing her message. But a bigger challenge for strategists may be managing voter perceptions about presidential timbre and gender. Let's gain perspective on this episode of That's History with Jonathan Zimmerman, historian with New York University. Jonathan, welcome back to Newsworks Tonight.
Good to be here as always.
And as a historical exercise, take us back to when women earned the right to vote in the United States.
Women earned the right to vote when the Constitution was amended in the early 20th century. And in the 19th century, I should say, there were a couple of women who tried to run for president. They were suffragists. But these were people who were running precisely because women couldn't get the vote.
And even they knew that their chances were slim and none.
Exactly, right, because in part because other women couldn't vote. But after we amended the Constitution, interestingly, it was a half century before the first modern woman declares that she wants to be president, and that was Margaret Chase Smith in 1964.
What do you think counted for that 50-year lag?
Well, you know, I think that one of the ironies of the 20th century of our history is that it's right around the time when women win the ballot that the United States begins its ascendancy into a world power, eventually a nuclear power and a national security state. And one of the things that the surveys keep telling us is that American voters, male and female, are loath to give a woman military power, military control. It's true that the Constitution says that the president is the commander-in-chief of the armed forces. But that term, armed forces, comes to mean something totally different in the 20th century. It means nuclear forces, and it means a kind of global dominance, which the United States enjoyed, starting really after the Second World War. And I think that's been a huge obstacle for women as presidential leaders. Let's emphasize that women have made great bounds in other kinds of leadership in this country. So there are almost 20 women in the Senate, some 80-odd women in the House of Representatives, not proportional to their representation in the population, but a huge boost over earlier eras, but still no president, or I might say vice president, that's female.
As you would know better than I, looking throughout history, it's hard to untangle military dominance and testosterone.
Yeah, indeed. But see, the voters associate the two. That's the point. And I think that's been one of the reasons why, although they've been fine with voting for a woman for senator or for the House of Representatives, it's a harder case to make, unfortunately, for a woman president.
Is this a uniquely American mindset, or does it go across the globe as well?
Oh, it's definitely American. You know, let's remind ourselves that the United Kingdom elected Margaret Thatcher three times. I think by many people's affirmation, the most effective leader in Europe right now is Angela Merkel of Germany. If you go down to South America, you know, Chile, Argentina, Brazil, they've all had female leaders. You know, the first national leader who was female was the president of Sri Lanka in the 50s. So the United States is way behind the curve, and I think that may have to do with how ahead of the curve it's been as a world power.
Let's get back to Hillary. There is such an extensive legacy about her, her deeds, and some say her misdeeds. How does one tease out perceptions about Hillary on their own merit versus perceptions about Hillary as a woman?
Well, I think it's next to impossible, because I think if you look especially at 2008, what you see is that Hillary was cast as either too female or not female enough. So remember Cleavagegate? I wish I could forget it. I mean, Cleavagegate happened when the Washington Post reported that Hillary Clinton allegedly was showing some cleavage on the Senate floor. Of course, her campaign struck back and saying you would never make a similar kind of statement about a male leader's dress. And then the Clinton campaign used this episode in a fundraising letter to try to appeal to voters, saying, you know, look how miscast, look how unfair the representations of Hillary have been. But then the narrative shifted and people used that letter to criticize Hillary as overly calculating and ambitious. So either you're excessively sexual or you're too ambitious, and neither critique is ever made of a male leader.
What do you foresee for Hillary as she tries to navigate her way?
I think it's going to be extremely difficult. My hope, however vain, is that in this next election cycle, we will judge her based on her achievements as Secretary of State and Senator and her political platforms, not on her gender.
Thank you, Jonathan.
Thank you. It was fun.
Jonathan Zimmerman is historian with New York University. You can hear That's History biweekly on WHYY. At Research Labs Worldwide, scientists work hard to answer some of mankind's biggest questions. What killed the dinosaurs? Does dark matter really exist? At Penn State, there's a lab devoted to a more practical question. How can we keep our roads, bridges, railroads, and other infrastructure from falling apart? Keystone Crossroads reporter Marielle Segarra paid a visit.
On the surface, Farshad Rajabipour's job might not sound that interesting. He's an associate professor of civil engineering at Penn State, and he studies concrete. Rajabipour is standing next to what looks like a giant kitchen mixer, but it's filled with cement, rocks, and water, the ingredients for concrete.
It's actually a material that is used pretty much everywhere in the world. I mean, it's so common that people don't notice it.
It's in the roads and bridges you drive over, the buildings where you live and work, even the pipes that transport your city's stormwater. Rajabipour works at Penn State's Civil Infrastructure Testing and Evaluation Lab. Researchers at the lab are devoted to making infrastructure safer, less expensive, and longer lasting. Pennsylvania's infrastructure is not in the best shape. The state has the second highest percentage of structurally deficient bridges in the country, after Rhode Island. That means those bridges need repairs, or they might be weight restricted or closed. And almost 44% of the state's roads were rated in fair or poor condition in 2013. Rajabipour's latest project could help the state. It's funded by the National Science Foundation, and the goal is to prevent a chemical reaction that makes bridges and other structures crack.
This type of reaction is very common in concrete.
The researchers are trying to come up with a sort of elixir, a substance they can add to concrete that'll prevent this chemical reaction or stop it from getting worse.
So this is one of the rooms that I want to show you.
The room is filled with buckets of concrete samples, all treated with different materials like natural clays and byproducts of aluminum. The researchers keep the room hot, about 100 degrees Fahrenheit. That helps them speed up the chemical reaction.
It's kind of like if you keep a food outside a refrigerator, it will go bad faster. The same thing will happen.
That means it'll only take them a few months to predict if their concoctions will allow us to make bridges and other structures last decades longer than they do now. There's no word on the results yet, But the state has a $4.7 billion budget to fix and build roads and bridges in the coming fiscal year. Extending the life of that infrastructure could save a lot of money. Penn State researchers are also looking for ways to catch safety problems before accidents happen. For instance, on railroads. So, a brief engineering lesson. Underneath railroad tracks, there's a layer of rocks. Those rocks will move a little when trains pass over the tracks. We're talking a couple millimeters a month. But if the rocks move too much, that can cause less comfortable rides. And if things got really bad...
If it's severe, then that would cause derailment.
That's Tong Q, one of the researchers at Penn State. He's working with the university's rail engineering program on a device that'll monitor railroad track safety in real time. It's funded by the Federal Railroad Administration. You're hearing the sound of a machine that looks like two transformer arms coming down on a metal beam that's resting on top of a bin of rocks. The machine mimics the force of a train going over railroad tracks. The researchers are using it to test something they've invented called a smart rock. It's a 3D printed rock that has electronics inside. The smart rock will sit underneath a section of train tracks and alert researchers if it's moving a lot. That'll be an early warning that the rock layer is rearranging and might need repairs. The state's transportation agency, PennDOT, also funds research at the Penn State Lab. The agency's research manager, Michael Benini, says the lab's work is really valuable.
University faculty members understand the transportation system within Pennsylvania, so they have an appreciation of the challenges we face trying to maintain and operate the system.
That's why even though there are national labs that study infrastructure, he says it helps to have one that's close to home. Mariel Segarra, Keystone Crossroads.
Keystone Crossroads is a statewide public media initiative reporting on the challenges facing Pennsylvania cities. WHYY leads the four-station partnership. Let's close this evening with an egg lover alert. Poultry leases have grown into a serious business across the country as more and more people want fresh eggs from local, humanely raised hens without the responsibility of owning chickens, which can live for up to 10 years. Companies like Pennsylvania-based Rent the Chicken offer packages including hens, a coop, supplies, and customer support. Birds can be returned early if things don't work out and are available for adoption if you decide you're ready for a commitment. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Benyakov and Kimberly Haas. Listen again to a story or catch up on a missed show via podcast or online at newsworks.org. Pennsylvania is home to more than a quarter of all pension plans in the United States. It's an often unwieldy and inefficient system where many towns have multiple plans for just a handful of employees. We'll look at possible solutions on tomorrow's show. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.
With one juicy spy novel, plus a healthy dose of madcap humor and a dash of hilarious whodunit, you get The 39 Steps, a comedy based on Alfred Hitchcock's movie, presented by Delaware's resident ensemble players now through May 10th. It's a fast-paced thriller of espionage and romance with four actors, 150 characters, and a wealth of inventive staging. 302-831-2204 or DelawareRep.org. The Rep supports WHYY.